next logical segment of our discussion is simply to, we've discussed alcohol and have some idea now of what it does. The next thing is to discuss those things that make the alcoholic different. So today, I want to take up with you the whole process of the whole disease that we refer to as alcoholism. Now, I think I can make a safe assumption that almost everybody in this room wanted to start over here at birth, and a long time later, arrive over here at a point of natural death at 110 or 150 years of age, and somehow or other not become involved with this thing that we hear an awful lot about called alcoholism. Now, there are certain myths that still exist about alcoholism. One of them is that somehow or other age gives some kind of protection against it. And frankly, I think we've known for a long time that age really doesn't provide much of any barrier to developing this disease for several reasons. First of all, we're a very considerate society. We provide pediatric booze. I think most of you can remember back to the days of Hadacol and the great and fantastic interest that the kids of that age in high school had about their vitamin consumption. You had to wade through mountains of ground glass just to get to the football stadiums. Nowadays, we have NyQuil, which is 40 to 50 proof, comes with a convenient shot glass strapped to the top, so that we, again, and it doesn't do a great deal about one's cold, but you don't notice it quite so much. After you've used this medicine. But alcoholic beverages, either in over-the-counter preparations or in the commercially available preparations, are available to almost any minor. In fact, we did a study in the 1958 which indicated that even at that time, social drinking was beginning at about age 13, and the youngsters that age and older had no difficulty in getting alcoholic beverages and fully expected to have them at unsupervised social occasions. Now, to totally dispel the myth of age being some kind of barrier against developing this disease, and I think the simple fact that there are an awful lot of people under 30 sitting in this room as patients now should dispel that, the most serious and life-threatening withdrawal that I've ever had occasion to treat was in a 17-year-old. This was a youngster whose mother was alcoholic, didn't like to drink alone, so invited him to begin to partake at the age of 9. By the time he was 10, his drinking was interfering with school, so he did what any red-blooded American alcoholic would do. He dropped out of school. By the time he was 12, he was in a local and very highly respected pediatric hospital, and they were hard-pressed to explain why he had developed high blood pressure, a rapid heartbeat, and had a couple of epileptic seizures. But the whole disorder spontaneously cleared up in 5 or 6 days, so they discharged him home undiagnosed. At the age of 14, he was in a nearby mental health facility for young people. And again, the reason that he was seeing spiders on his bed and around the light fixtures in the room totally escaped the people. And again, he underwent a spontaneous remission from his disorder in about 5 or 6 days. So he was discharged again, diagnosed this time as being psychotic. But I think that subsequent events have determined that he isn't. Now, at the age of 17, he arrived at one of the boys' training schools. And within 30 minutes, I was on the scene. And here was a 17-year-old whose blood pressure should look like this, which looked like this. A youngster whose pulse should be about 70 beats a minute, I think was around 165, but it was going so fast that we couldn't even count it. He'd had two massive epileptic seizures, and obviously was in full-blown delirium tremens. Now, it only took the equivalent of about 35 or 36 sleeping capsules, very rapidly by vein, to get this young man even off the ceiling. And frankly, he was as close to death as any individual that I've seen ever admitted to this hospital or any other treatment facility that I've been connected with. So I think we have to give up the myth of age. Young people can get alcoholic beverages. Young people can develop the alcoholic disease. And I think very much like diabetes, in young people who can develop the disease very rapidly, it seems to be a very malignant and destructive kind of form of the disease. It oftentimes creates much more damage over a far shorter period of time. Well, frankly, if we give up age as any kind of barrier at all, then what do we depend on to go all the way from here over to here? Well, this really depends on your individual equipment, your individual psychological and social preparation to deal with the great North American Drinking Society. Now, frankly, because they have better press relationships, the people who describe psychological findings have had a great deal more press than people in the other school. And frankly, again, I think that this sometimes represents and gives a distorted view of the alcoholic, simply because people with emotional problems go to see people who can fix emotional problems, so that anybody in this particular branch of the science is going to make the assumption, if they don't have a widespread sample, that everybody who has this problem has this kind of emotional problem. Well, they seem to boil down, if you're going to look for trends at all, and this really isn't determining alcoholism as much as it's determining the pressures that are going to produce the amount of drinking necessary to create alcoholism, is that they boil down to two groups. Those people who have rather severe disturbances in brain function, which usually affect perception. The youngster who comes in from the backyard and describes to mommy that he's just had a half an hour conversation with the devil off beside the road bush. Mommy goes through the ceiling and he says, "Good Lord, I can't talk to her about things like this anymore," so he goes through a good number of years simply not telling anybody. Well, that's calculated to make you a little nervous, and as soon as you find booze out behind the garage with your brother or sister, you found a solution to all this problem. And unfortunately, if you happen to be the kind of person who can develop alcoholism as well, you're going to get there pretty quick. The other person is the person who seems to be, whether or not in an institution or outside, really deprived of the opportunity to learn how to deal with day-to-day decisions. And we find people who, it's really a major problem to decide whether to get up, what to wear today, what to eat today, and frankly, they don't tolerate or cope with life very, very well. And certainly this makes for a very tense and anxious kind of individual. Alcohol does represent a partial solution. And in people with these kinds of problems, they tend to drink more quicker and get to the disease much faster. But, you know, when we start doing studies of people who come to treatment centers like this and Hazelden and Chit Chat Farms and so forth, we find that the vast majority of people really don't demonstrate any consistent pattern of mental health problems and really don't demonstrate many mental health problems that don't go away once the drinking disappears. But there are a whole battery of other lacks that do permit people to be enticed into drinking a great deal over a very short period of time. And it's simply because our society doesn't prepare us effectively to deal with the great North American Drinking Society. Now, if we borrow a leaf from the transactional analysis people, they sort of view the whole human personality as one great big cartridge like this, and they make the basic assumption, and I think properly so, that we all start out with a bundle of basic childlike drives, to drink when we're thirsty, to eat when we're hungry, to get warm when we're cold, and so forth. Now, as we become older, expressing these things becomes somewhat annoying to the people around us, so they start to tell us where to head in. And they begin to program us very much like a computer and tell us that this is a no-no and this is okay. And eventually, if everything works out right, we develop a nice adult compartment in the middle that allows us to express these childlike drives under the control of the programmed-in information in a nice, mature, and adult sort of fashion. Well, society programs their young by certain rules. You know, we get certain inputs that are transmitted by parents. They continue and turn it over to the school system. We also have some religious background as well that contributes to this whole body of information. Then we have those hard heads that are difficult to reach that we have to employ law enforcement officers and a judicial system to kind of get the message to them. And then finally, we spend the whole rest of our life with our peers who give us a great deal more information as to what's proper behavior and what isn't. Now, this whole battery of programming gives us the ammunition with which to deal with drinking decisions. And frankly, we don't do a terribly good job. In fact, over the last 50 years, we've only found two groups in the United States and Canada who have done a fairly decent job. These are the Orthodox Jews and the non-Christian Chinese who live in certain large cities throughout the country. And see, these people who are non-Christian Chinese really adhere to the China of 150 years ago, the 1830s, and certainly nothing that has to do with present-day Chinese ideology. Now, frankly, back in the 40s, we made a guess that perhaps these two groups might even have inherited protection against developing the alcoholic disease. And then they blew our theory sky high. The Orthodox Jewish faith broke into a less Orthodox branch, and they started contributing their fair share of alcoholics to the total population. And I love to say this over at Guest House, as the non-Christian Chinese become Christians, they become drunks with the same frequency as any other group. So, frankly, there was something inherent in the rearing of these young people and their preparation to deal with drinking decisions in society, along with juvenile delinquency and adult criminal acting out and a great number of other problems that seem to give them fairly good protection against developing these kinds of problems. Now, frankly, we're in danger of a rather common phenomenon in this day and age, and that's simply that both of these groups may become extinct before we find out what they're doing. And therefore, we're going to be deprived of some of the best evidence around so far as prevention of the alcoholic disease and perhaps prevention of many other social problems as well. So people of the magnitude of Selden Bacon are running around trying to communicate with the remnants of both of these groups before they vanish from the face of the earth and try and find out what it is that they do that protects their young so well against alcoholism, drug abuse, and many other problems. Now, frankly, I think that we're probably not going to do it in time. And so we're probably not ever going to know, and certainly the answers aren't the simplistic answers that pop to mind. It isn't feeding young people alcoholic beverages when they're young. It's not setting a good or a bad example for them. It's something much more complex than that, and we only wish we knew what it was. Well, frankly, then, looking at this group, I don't think there are many people who have had that kind of protection against drinking too much. So most people go over the edge and fall into a group that's not alcoholism. They now fall into a group of people who drink a little bit more than they should. And this group really gave us a lot of difficulty so far as defining terms until about 7 years ago, one of my colleagues coined the term problem drinker. Now, this really describes the situation very well and has made it a very handy tool for us to conceptualize that sort of plateau in between. And not all problem drinkers will become alcoholic. In fact, when we began to establish the 19 early alcohol action safety programs throughout the country, we really thought it was far more important to know how many problem drinkers there were in a community than really the number of alcoholics. So we had to set out to determine how many of these people were around. And it really gave us a great deal of difficulty because we were sitting at a conference room in one of the hotels in Washington, D.C., and one of my colleagues stood up and said, well, you know, what we're really looking for is somebody, you know, who has drank to the point where they've seriously compromised their life in one way or another. So what we were looking for was somebody whose wife had a problem, whose local judge had a problem, whose local social service agency had a problem, whose local friend of the court had a problem. But, you know, these people, if you asked them, didn't have any problem at all. So you couldn't really go around in the 1970 census and say, do you have somebody in the house who's completely surrounded by people who have problems but doesn't have any himself and get any kind of accurate count as to how many problem drinkers were around. So what we decided to do was take the hard route and just get the small tip of the iceberg, we thought. So we thought we'd go after those things that we could measure. You know, we made the basic assumption, I think it was proper and correct, that most people consider being tossed in jail for 30 to 90 days is somewhat compromising the way they'd like to spend their life. The loss of one's driving privileges for a year represents that same sort of thing. The loss of one's job, the loss of one's earning capacity by being confined in a hospital, or the necessity of seeking some kind of outside help where they could say that the help was necessary directly due to the consumption of alcohol. These were all things that we could get on computer tapes that were laying around the country. So we decided to go after those people who had come to the attention of the court and had either been remanded to jail or their driver's license removed, people who had lost their job or been warned they were going to lose their job, people who were confined to hospitals for diseases directly related to the consumption of alcohol, or people who were in marital and family difficulty where the social worker determined that alcohol was a fairly major part of the cause. And we thought, you know, since most people got driven home a half a dozen times before they ever got sent to jail, most of them had many encounters with the courts before anybody took their license away. Most people had been warned 15 or 20 times by the foreman before anybody in the personnel office ever heard about it, that we'd only get the very tip of the iceberg, and did we get a surprise. After we got our figures together and projected them on a national basis, it was estimated that at a time when there were 101 million adult drinkers in this country, 40 million of those 101 had drank to the point where they'd lost their privilege to drive, and had been incarcerated in jail, had gotten into employment difficulty, gotten into family or marital difficulty at least once in their life. Well, all of a sudden, we had a brand new ball game so far as statistics were concerned, because we knew there were roughly 10 million alcoholics in this country. And, you know, for many years, we'd walked around saying to any given individual, you know, there's about a 5% chance that you're an alcoholic. One out of every 20 adult drinkers may eventually become an alcoholic. And, you know, that didn't impress anybody. They said, if I've got a 5% chance of being an alcoholic, I'll take my chances on the 95%, you know, and continue to drink another couple of years. Thank you. Well, now, when we run into somebody who has been warned by his employer or in trouble with the law or had to have been hospitalized because of alcohol-related health problems, we're not talking about a 5% chance. We're talking about a 25% chance. One in four people who have drank to the point where they've seriously interfered with the expression of their life are already involved with a disease that's going to destroy their mind or take their life. So there's a 25% chance now when the employee or personnel man who sent you here to Brighton Hospital was first beginning to observe your case, and that's why he observed it. Because people who do these kinds of things have a very great possibility of being alcoholic. So frankly, we now know what the high-risk group is. We now know which people to watch very closely. And now we're beginning to benefit by this by simply having early intervention and people sent to a treatment center like this with what we call benevolent coercion or tough love. You know, I didn't used to have to wait down here to see if everybody was in the lecture hall. I could hear the patients coming down the hall. Their livers would be sloshing back and forth in 40 pounds of water. We had no problems with that kind of thing, simply because the people who came here were desperately ill, usually had no financial or personal resources, didn't have any job to go back to, their health was down to about the bottom line, and our success rate with this kind of individual was extremely poor. Now we have people who are reasonably healthy, or who are going out with four tires on the ground and a spare in the trunk. They're going out with all kinds of resources to work with, and our success rate is beginning to soar, simply because we now know how to find the high-risk group, the problem drinker. Well, what separates the problem drinker from the individual who goes the whole way, all the way down to full expression of the alcoholic disease and death and insanity? Well, this has given us a lot of trouble over a good number of years. Now, back in the very early days of the Yale Summer School on Alcoholism Studies, which at that time probably had gathered together the best brains and the most knowledgeable people about alcoholism that we knew at the time, these people gathered together all of the material that was written about alcoholism and read it all, and they sat down to create a drawing or a model of the alcoholic disease. And they worked at it for a couple of days, and they just couldn't come up with anything that could work. And finally, after all of their struggles, the dean of the medical school, Dr. Haggard, struggled to his feet and said, "Gentlemen, you're not going to put any kind of model of alcoholism on the board unless you make an assumption." And they didn't like the idea, but they agreed. And he said, "Right at this level, the thing that determines a person who goes from the problem drinker level on down to full-blown alcoholism, we have to assume that there is some sort of physiological determinant. And since we don't know what it is, we'll simply call it the physiological X factor, simply because nobody knows what this thing is. Well, we've been arguing about this physiological X for the last 45 years. Now, the first man to be asked was Dr. Silkworth, who was the one of the early pioneers in alcoholism. And, you know, he made a rather astute sort of observation. He said, you know, if you eat a peanut and you're allergic to it right now, you're going to break out with hives. If you don't eat any peanuts for the next 5, 10, or 15 years and then eat them again, you're going to break out with the same hives or worse. So I think alcoholism is like an allergy. And no matter how long one abstains from alcohol, when you're contacted again, you're going to get just as sick as you were before. Well, the funny thing about it is there's a school up in Canada who now are describing central nervous system or brain allergy responses, and they look fairly close to the kind of things we've been studying over the last few years, so we may be right back where we started. But you know, in the meantime, we suddenly started looking for the physiological X in earnest. And all of a sudden, in the late 1950s and the early 1960s, we actually had too many candidates. I can remember standing up here on this lecture platform and sort of describing it as being born and reaching up out of your crib and grabbing a hold of the handle of a hereditary one-armed bandit, and all of the wheels went around, and if you came up with 11 lemons in a row, you were going to be alcoholic. If you came up with 7 Liberty Bells and 5 lemons, you probably weren't going to make it. And it was a very complex sort of theory. Now, we've actually since that time found that most of these things were the result of drinking and not the cause of alcoholism, so most of those have been discarded, except that they're still considered in the treatment of the alcoholic. Now, frankly, that left us in about 1964 without any current front-running theories so far as what alcoholism's physiological X might be. And that was really a fairly good place to have this happen, because we began to really know that we were discovering more and more about how the human brain works. We were beginning to notice that alcohol had very little to do with alcoholism, that you could create alcoholism with a great number of other chemicals. So alcohol metabolism probably had very little to do with alcoholism and the physiological X as well. And we also had the beginnings of the experimentation of young people with many other kinds of recreational drugs, which forced us to learn a great deal more about how the brain worked very quickly. Well, suddenly we started to have some clues that began to fall into line. And one of them originated at the University of Southern California, where this group had the audacity to report that drunks get drunk in a different way than the amateurs do. Now, they reported in any group, and this has been confirmed over and over again, that 80% of any random group that you pick will be able to give you the time, the place, the color of the tapestries on the wall, the location of the pictures, the first and last name of everybody in the room, the exact date of the 10, 11, or 12 times they've ever been voluntarily drunk in their lives. Now, this really indicated to these researchers that getting drunk was a rather momentous event, and it was. These people said that they felt completely out of control, terribly conspicuous, totally at the mercy of everybody in the room. They had absolutely no confidence at all. They almost invariably asked someone else to drive them home. And if they had to drive home themselves, it was at 2 miles an hour with the side door of the car open, tracing their finger down the white line in the middle of the highway for fear they'd make some kind of mistake. Now, this really, if this is the majority report in an apparently is, would mean that this group had the perfect right to think that anybody who drank voluntarily to the point of intoxication very often would have to be out of their gourd, and they coined terms like dipsomania, implying that anybody who drank to their end result would have to be insane. But the alcoholic is vindicated. The minority report says something entirely different. When this group is asked how many times they've been intoxicated, they say, you got to be kidding, or can I borrow your computer, or I can't count that high, doc, which gives an idea that they're drunk a little bit more often. And now the subjective input is the real key. They say they feel bigger than life, turned on, omnipotent, and they certainly can drive far more properly drunk than sober. You know, officer, I drove because I'm too drunk to walk. You know, euphoric thinking. And frankly, can you see what kind of thing happens in the early days? This group is asking this group to drive them home. This group is driving this group home. This group is asking this group, how bad did they behave last night? Did my lampshade trick turn anybody off? And this group was telling them exactly how they behaved last night. And this group is telling this group, boy, you don't have anything to fear from alcohol at all. And these people are the ones who are eventually going to develop a disease that's going to destroy their brain or take their life. So all of the initial inputs are wrong. Now we go to the University of Texas, and there's a researcher there, a lady by the name of Davis, who said, you know, this can't be true. We're talking about a sedative, and these people are acting like they took a stimulant. And we've known for a long time that if you drink faster than your liver can burn it, your blood alcohol level goes up. And as your blood alcohol level goes up, you demonstrate those symptoms known as intoxication. And this is a perfectly normal anesthetic function. And you can go from 0.00 up to 0.15, where the law says you're intoxicated, 0.30, where my textbook says you should be dead, 0.45, where some of you came in with your suitcases, asked where your bed was, and crawled gently into bed without showing any signs of impairment at all, which gives you some idea of where blood alcohol levels stand around here, too. Well, in normal people, the 80%, as the blood alcohol level goes up, three chemicals in the brain that regulate sleep and dreaming and mood and sense of alertness simply become exhausted. And since one does have to do with sleep, at the point that it becomes very low, the individual simply goes to sleep. Now, we find that it's extremely difficult to drink while you're sleeping, so at that point, the blood alcohol level drops, the brain recovers, and about 6 or 7 hours later, we're back awake again. But you know, it took 10 or 11 ounces to get that drunk in the first place, so we spend the rest of the morning wandering around, bumping into door jams, shaking hands with doorknobs, and along comes some practice professional indoor drinker and says, why did you have a morning drink when you got a hangover like that, which you try once, and you end up being sick longer, and this literally gives a person, the vast majority of people, who can't get a good snoot full anyway because they pass out and go to sleep, they feel absolutely rotten the next day with a sedative hangover, and all the advice that we professional drinkers give them makes them feel only worse, and they give up on alcohol as bad news right from the beginning. Well, this isn't what happens to the budding alcoholic and the practicing alcoholic, and this is where we start getting into trouble. Because instead of going on to the point of exhaustion, the alcoholic's brain simply adapts to this sedative environment, and the outpouring of these chemicals simply becomes greater as the alcohol level goes up. And this raises a rather interesting point. The ceiling of the tolerance of any practicing alcoholic is infinity. Now, we didn't really have a chance to explore this until we started getting alcohol in solid form. And I met people like Big John N., who could take 3,000 milligrams of Librium a day and wash it down with a fifth of booze. Now, that's enough to knock down a bull elephant, and John was talking and walking pretty good. So we really found people who can, with the advent of the barbiturates and the minor tranquilizers and all these other goodies, can develop and demonstrate some pretty fantastic tolerances to all of these sedative drugs. But, you know, in most cases, the opportunity to drink is limited, the size of our stomach limits our drinking, or the size of our pocketbook does, and eventually we have to taper off. And then a very interesting thing happens. When the blood alcohol or the body sedative level remains at a constant point, the brain simply adapts to that point. And suddenly the antidepressant response of the brain balances out the sedations coming from the outside, and something happens that alcoholics have been telling scientists was happening for years. The alcoholic can drink himself sober. He can operate an automobile, carry out very complex business, carry on his day-to-day business, and give all of the external appearances of being stone-cold sober and be knocking off a fifth of whiskey a day or better. Or 400 milligrams of Valium, or 3,000 milligrams of Librium, and still look pretty good. And it's simply because in the alcoholic we have the ability to adapt. Now, this is why we have the German alcoholic, old Hans the Burgermeister, who runs his village and with a great deal of success, runs his vineyard and makes a great profit, operates his automobile and never gets a ticket, first pillar in the church there every Sunday morning, and finally at the age of 45 he develops gallbladder trouble, goes into the hospital, and 3 days after the the surgery, Hans is strapped to the bed in full-blown DTs, and everybody makes the miraculous discovery that Hans has got a drinking problem. Simply because they allowed him to sober up, the brain doesn't handle this too well, and we'll talk about this on Friday. We simply have an overshoot here and develop those symptoms that we refer to as withdrawal symptoms. So the presence of the ability to adapt, the presence of the ability to plateau out, and the presence of withdrawal symptoms are hallmarks of the alcoholic. Now, this is not a specific reaction. It has nothing to do with acetaldehyde. You can make this happen with phenobarbital, Librium, Valium, Equinil, Cirax, Sorental, and a whole variety of different drugs. Now, you've also heard
cells are great big square cells like this. They have a command module in the center. And we used to feel that alcohol was burned at an ounce per hour rate in little floating factories called mitochondria. And this is where alcohol goes to acetone and then to vinegar. And this is pretty well limited to an ounce per hour. And if you force little laboratory animals to drink more alcohol, these mitochondria factories will get bigger, but the ability to burn alcohol doesn't get a whole lot greater. And then we were faced with another perplexing problem. We suddenly started to notice that practicing professional indoor drinkers, many of them had the capacity to burn far more than an ounce of alcohol per hour. We passed, for instance, in Michigan, the implied consent law, which said that by virtue of applying for a driver's license, you gave any officer of the law the privilege of having you blow up the breathalyzer. Of course, there were strings attached. Now, down around Jackson and Kalamazoo, there developed the fall-down school, which simply means that unless you had the Constitution read to you, you didn't have to blow up the machine. So as soon as the lights were flashing beside your car, you opened up the side door, stepped out, and fell flat on your face. And as long as you clung to the ground and to the stretcher when the ambulance came and to the emergency room gurney for an hour or two, many of these people were able to pass the breathalyzer test. Now, over around Grand Rapids and Muskegon, they had the Speedy Lawyer School, and you have a right to have a lawyer present when you're taking the breathalyzer test. You'd call up, and your lawyer would assure you he'd be over immediately, leave his office, go home, shower and shave, take his wife out to dinner in the theater, and in the middle of the Johnny Carson program, remember, he was supposed to be down at the jailhouse. There was a fantastic record of false arrests around that part of the country for many, many months. But you know, the arresting officers kept telling us, you know, these guys looked a whole lot worse than the breathalyzer looked a couple hours later, and I wonder if they couldn't be sobering up by some special technique. Well, a Dr. Charles Lieber on Manhattan Island found the answer for us. He found out that these professional indoor alcohol burners developed a whole network of small little canals in the unused part of the cell, and as this canal network increased, they were able to burn alcohol, phenobarbital, Librium, Valium, Equinil, Miltown, with a fantastically increased kind of degree. Well, now there's good news and there's bad news. This means that you can burn sedatives far more rapidly, but it also means that the cell is so highly specialized that it is eventually doomed to death. And then those people I know who can burn 6 and 8 ounces of alcohol per hour, the amount of cirrhosis they show is proportionately higher. This also explains the difference between nutritional cirrhosis, which really has never impressed anybody since World War II. We had people coming home with nutritional cirrhosis from prisoner of war camps, and on an adequate diet, it would heal up in 3 or 4 years, and they never did get sick from it. But you know, an alcoholic's liver looks like somebody has blasted it at short range with a double-aught shotgun. There are large patches that have just totally disappeared, and other parts that look pretty good. But when you realize that these changes occur most likely around blood vessels, and that the cells around the blood vessels are dying the most rapidly, the alcoholic with cirrhosis has simply walled off the blood vessels with thick layers of scar tissue, so nothing can get from the bloodstream to the cells that are still working, nothing can get from the cells that are still working back to the bloodstream, and the alcoholic is treated to the prospect of dying, even though half of his liver may look pretty good. So we now have so many answers to these kinds of problems. Now, why do the two occur together? And why do we see people who have taken nothing but phenobarbital start to develop cirrhosis of the liver? We thought alcohol was the only thing that could do that. Well, then we made a discovery right here locally that the chemicals that allow the alcoholic to adapt to high levels of sedation occur in two forms. Have you ever held the page of a book up to a mirror and you had the printed page and the mirror reversed the whole thing and so you had a reverse or mirror image?
Well, the proteins or the chemicals that allow this to happen work only in the brain if they happen to be the mirror or the reversed image. And the normal form happens to work over here in the liver. And all of a sudden, we were confronted with a lot of intriguing kinds of facts. If the person can turn out 2 to 3 times the normal amount over here, they must be turning out 2 to 3 times less than normal amount over here. And we started feeding little rats a diet deficient in these kinds of proteins. And what did? They started developing the little canals. So probably when we're talking about the physiological X, we're talking about a little printing press laying around the body, probably in the liver and in the heart and in the brain, which is turning out too much of one form of chemical regulator and too little of another. And this really means that if we took all the alcoholics in the world and piled them up into a bunch, we'd have something that looked just like this. And this is the same sort of thing we have for diabetes. And what this curve really means is that every case of alcoholism is different from every other case. It means that it's totally inappropriate for you to sit down in the lounge and say, I'm not an alcoholic because I drank less or more than you did. It really doesn't make any difference at all. We have people up here, like that 17-year-old, who on whatever alcohol he could get together and whatever pills he could scrape up off the street, was able to develop a life-threatening disease by the time he was 17. Now, this group over here probably represents most of you in this room. With a normal amount of alcohol, over a respectable period of years, you develop the disease. Now, there's probably even a couple of these folks over here who really weren't going to be denied the alcoholic disease. They were going to work on it every day, drink more and more and more because they wanted to be an alcoholic in the worst way, and they weren't going to let anybody cheat them out of it, and they were going to work on it for 20 or 25 years and eventually make the grade with the rest of their buddies. And finally, there's probably a group over here, even though I haven't seen them, who, regardless of how much they drink, probably are never going to be able to develop the disease. Okay, are we talking about a genetic disease? Maybe we are, maybe we are. I know we're talking about something very much like diabetes, simply because the incidence of alcoholism in this country and the incidence of diabetes have been the same for as long as we've ever kept any kind of statistics. Now, what about this whole thing? Is it really an inherited disease? Should I sit up nights worrying about my children? Probably not. You know, we've done some philosophizing in medicine about diabetes itself. You know, it may not under all circumstances be a disease. There are certain very knowledgeable people who refer to diabetes as a genetic lifeboat. Frankly, diabetics can do without food much better and much longer than non-diabetics. We found that out during the prisoner of war experiences in Korea, Vietnam, and World War II. This means that there have been times in mankind's history when calories haven't been too plentiful. The diabetic has probably responded by being able to carry us through. When we arrived at the other side of the famine and calories were plentiful again, we rewarded the diabetic by overfeeding him so he would die back to the same 10% of the population that he usually occupies. Now, can or does the alcoholic fall into the same group? Well, you know, it's beginning to be strongly suggested that they do. Simply because we've discovered some other very interesting things about people whose brains and livers can adapt to sedatives. We simply discovered that these people apparently can do without with much less oxygen than their fellows can. You know, one of the cells that dies in the brain that we see in all alcoholics who have succumbed to their disease are the Purkinje cells. And the only time we see damaged Purkinje cells otherwise are in people who have died of suffocation. So apparently alcoholics can take the same reduction in oxygen in the air they breathe that would kill their fellows, and they still continue to breathe. Well, we've got other evidence as well. I was involved in an animal experiment where we were creating the animal model of DTs. So we had a lot of animals prepared to get the shakes on Monday morning. Well, the chemicals that are necessary to do this are destroyed if they're exposed to air, so we kept them all stored under nitrogen. One afternoon, we walked out, slammed the laboratory door, the nitrogen tank fell off the wall, hit a laboratory desk, broke the neck off, and here's a room completely loaded with nitrogen to the point where we would expect that all the animals would be dead. We came in the next morning, and most of the animals were. But there were six little eyes peering at us out of the darkness, and these were the three animals that were prepared to have DTs the next day. Well, we repeated this experiment over and over again, and as soon as you get those chemicals in the brain to high levels, these animals could survive reduction of oxygen in the atmosphere that would consistently kill their fellow animals. So what does this mean? This means that really, in this day of increasing befouling of our air and increasing air pollution, it is perfectly possible that some morning every alcoholic and every potential alcoholic will wake up and wonder where everybody else went. Now, on that basis, I really can't consider it all bad news. And this really means that even though I shake in fear and trepidation when I walk into a closed meeting and see the cloud bank closing in about shoulder level, that I don't have to despair you're surviving this experience, but, simply because you're equipped to handle less oxygen than other ordinary mortals. So I think we're getting fairly close to the physiological X. We're getting to some very interesting kinds of findings, and we're at least getting some facts that do explain what we observe and do explain the fact that alcoholism has very little to do with alcohol except that it's the most convenient sedative around. Well, what I've talked about to this point isn't going to create one alcoholic. Now, you probably look a little shocked there. But frankly, you know, the American Indian had very little individual psychological and social protection against drinking. Obviously, the American Indian had the physiological X because, you know, we got quite a few bona fide dyed-in-the-wool alcoholics running around the reservations. And the thing that was really the key factor was whether or not they were exposed to alcohol. You know, if any of you believe that Pulp magazine bunk that the West was one with a 44, you're crazy. It was one with Jim Beam, Old Crow, and Old Granddad. That did more to decimate the Indian nation than any other single factor. So, to make our picture complete, we have to discuss those things that might make us drink a little bit more than we should. So, we'll put us all going down the road of life here and discuss the things that might make us drink a little bit more than the average individual. Now, first of all, is simply how much alcohol is around. This has to do with availability. Now, the last figures I have are for 1972, and this was a time when the United States, Canada, and Mexico produced 60% of all of the booze offered for sale anywhere on the face of the earth. Now, this wasn't enough for our domestic needs, so we imported 80% of the booze manufactured and offered for sale anywhere else on the face of the earth, which means that 80% of all of the commercial stuff was between Hudson Bay and Panama Canal. Now, the next time you go by a globe and you see the map of North America, and if it doesn't look like a cocktail glass balancing on the shoulder of South America with foam sloshing out through Alaska, I'll miss my guess. Well, frankly, that simply determines that there is no excuse for anybody with any pocketbook doing without alcoholic beverages. And this is pretty good, because frankly, this means that we don't have to treat as many people drinking Sterno and wood alcohol anymore, simply because a bottle of soda pop wine is 10 cents cheaper than a can of Sterno. We have to have money to buy it in most countries in the world. Now, in this country, if you don't have enough money, we'll put you on welfare and buy it for you anyway. So it really doesn't make a whole lot of difference. Economics doesn't make a great deal of difference in this country. So if money doesn't make the difference, then the thing that makes alcoholics out of people quicker than any other thing is having the available free time to consume it. So we find that the very rich and the very poor become alcoholics earlier than most other groups. Those people who have a great deal of supervision over how they spend their time. The housewife represented here, the traveling salesman, the teacher, the doctor. All of these people are people who have control over their time and therefore have a great deal more opportunity to develop the disease far earlier. Now, there are some rather interesting economic things on a worldwide basis, and we'll run through those very quickly. For instance, we wondered why 20% of the people on the Portuguese fishing coast were dying of cirrhosis of the liver, and they didn't have any apparent alcoholism at all. Well, as soon as we got over there, we realized why they didn't have any alcoholism. They took such a dim view of public intoxication that anybody who had a real problem went to the catacombs and didn't surface until they were ready to die, just about like they do in Italy. But frankly, we also found out alcohol was cheaper than bread by several cents. So the staple diet in Portugal was simply booze and fish, a high-protein, high-alcohol kind of diet. So that it was not any wonder anymore why people simply went on, since they never withdrew, never had an opportunity to know whether they were alcoholic or not. They just simply went to the age of 55, their liver fell out on the pavement, and they self-destruct. Now, I also have to tell you about France before I get off this subject, and I don't want you to be all running down to the travel bureau. But, you know, France, about 60% of every dollar is in taxes is contributed by the alcohol-related industry. So over there, the alcohol-producing industry represents a rather major and vocal lobby. And in France, the alcoholic is considered, number one, a necessary evil, and number two, something bordering on a national hero. So when Pierre hits the bricks in Paris, he's scraped up by the gendarmerie, whisked off to a free government detoxification center, poured in between clean white sheets, nursed back to health tenderly for the next 5 or 6 weeks, handed a bottle of cognac at the door, and vive la France, Pierre is back on the street. Well, you know, nobody's going to go to those silly meetings with that kind of competition. So there are some rather interesting economic inputs, but certainly not in this country. Now, the next factor is simply the effect of religion. And you would gather that this might be a rather tricky subject, but it really isn't, because there's only two theological schools of thought about booze in this country anyway. One's the thou shalt not school, and the other's the ambivalent, it's okay if you drink like a lady or a gentleman, but we're going to suspect your morals if you lose control and become an alcoholic. Now, let's examine the first one first, which simply tells their young people, don't drink, smoke, chase young ladies, breathe air, or do much of anything else. And as this youngster grows up, there's a certain amount of evidence that perhaps there are people that hold other ideas. You know, they're unloading the tents from the Scoutmaster station wagon, and he doesn't happen to share these same ideas, and he happens to look up into the kitchen, and here's the old dear Scoutmaster, a man he loves, celebrating surviving the weekend with the kids by downing a nice cold bottle of Stroh's. Now, he doesn't get struck by lightning, he doesn't turn into Satan personified, and the kid just files us away. Now, 3 years later, they're coming back from Lansing, they've just won the state basketball championship. And they pull up in Weberville to get some gas, and you know what happens, the coach and the assistant coach turn up missing. Now, he's given the job of going to find him, he makes one left at the main street, and there they are, belly up to the bar, celebrating the victory. Now, here's two more men that he absolutely worships, not struck by lightning, not turned into Satan personified, and if you have any association with 17-year-olds, you know that they have a slight imperceptible tendency to question what we've told them anyway. And given this kind of ammunition, they're sure that we played some kind of desperate game on them, and they're going to go out and catch up and make for lost time. They usually become alcoholic in their early 20s. They usually respond to treatment very well. They're looking for an alternate value system and latch onto AA without any problems at all, and they're the kinds we like to see coming because they make any treatment center look good. Not so for the ambivalent school. Let's examine how most of us in this room became sinners. We drank with the same bunch on the same nights of the week, the same amount, and came home and crawled in our bed and got up and went about our business the next day. 4, 5, or 6 years later, we went out with the same bunch, drank the same amount of booze, crawled into the same bed, but the next morning wasn't quite the same. The 7th Cavalry had marched through our mouth, dropping off bales of hay. Somebody was pounding on an empty oil drum in the middle of our skull. Our blood pressure was pushing our eyeballs out from the inside. Somebody poured a scuttle full of hot coals down in our stomach. We broke into a cold sweat just thinking about getting a glass of water that we knew we had to have to survive. And the only thing that we were absolutely certain of at this particular point is a person in this shape couldn't possibly live until noon. Now, the next thing that crossed our mind is some advice that another professional indoor drinker gave us, that all we need is a little bit of the hair of the dog that bit us. So we rummage out in the kitchen, get the cooking sherry, pour out a glass, down it goes, and 20 minutes later, we're restored to glowing health. And at that moment, we have lost control. And, you know, most of us are like the Terrington smoker. We would rather die than switch. I've seen people whose livers had fell out on the pavement, who had just had major surgery in their abdomen to get their esophageal varices to quit bleeding, who looked you right in the eye and said, Doctor, I am not an alcoholic. So, at this point, most of us would rather die than switch, and we begin to develop all kinds of elaborate defenses. So the religious aspect doesn't create any more alcoholics. It just is, if you have the ambivalent background, it creates a lot more dead ones through the mechanism of denial and guilt. Now, the final two factors we can deal with rather quickly. One of them is simply what our society has done to alcohol. And frankly, our society has done three things that are fairly bad. One of them is simply the fact that alcohol has been made a barometer of pleasure. Think back to the last party you were to and try and remember who told the best joke or what single activity was the most fun. You're not going to remember, but you're sure going to remember how many dead soldiers the host or hostess said they threw in the ash can the next day, or how many empty cases they took back for exchange at the local beer store. You know, you're going to find as you leave Brighton Hospital and successfully stay sober, particularly with the coming season, that you're going to be invited to an AA New Year's party, and you may think you got to the wrong place, that you got into a Presbyterian Sunday school or something, because it's extremely difficult for people who abstain from alcohol to find out how to have a good time. You eventually do. We had one woman who had a complete and total nervous breakdown four days after she came into the hospital. It took us 3 days to get her down off the ceiling, and you know what she said the moment she came to? As I was sitting in my room, and the thought crossed my mind that I was never going to have fun again. You know, that would give me a nervous breakdown if I thought that for my price for abstinence was going to be a complete and total abstinence of fun for the rest of my life. So, as I say, many of us find it almost inconceivable to think about having any kind of good time without alcohol being there. Now, also, alcohol is a status symbol. You know, we are concerned about the kind of car we drive, the kind of clothes we wear. Well, we're concerned about the kind of booze we drink. You know, you go into a friend's house after you've left Brighton Hospital, and he offers you a small snifter of Haig and Haig pinch bottle, and you say, gee, no, I can't. I'm a member of AA. And what have you said? I don't believe you. I don't think you can afford to give everybody a shot of Haig and Haig. And all of a sudden, he's got his nose bent, and you've created a major social faux pas. So, frankly, we fear this as well. And finally, have you ever wondered about the bizarre and weird pattern by which most of us drink? You know, no place else in the world is this person who will drink for 2 or 3 weeks, shake for a week and a half, and then start the whole process over again. We suffer over and over and over again. We're the country of the intermittent binge drinker, the idiot who alternately gets sick, the idiot who goes through withdrawal so many times that since the chances of our dying is 1 out of 20, most of us have laid our life on the line 2 or 3 times by the time we've come to a treatment center like here. And the reason that we have this bizarre pattern, which we've exported to Japan and to Scandinavia, and they're not terribly happy about it at all, is simply because we're the country of the office New Year's picnic party, the Saturday afternoon Legion picnic. We drink, we smoke, we eat as though the supply was going to run out tomorrow. The average European sits over there on the other side of the water and simply shakes their head. They can't understand this whole kind of behavior. So we sort of drink as though the supply was going to dry up tomorrow, and this produces a very life-threatening, painful form of alcoholism that we call the intermittent binge. Now, finally, we'll get back to the subject that we hear a great deal about, and that's the factors that occur in our mass psychology that may promote drinking. Well, frankly, if we're talking about future shock, urban crowding, nerves of all sorts, if that were the cause of alcoholism, most of the people in this country would be alcoholic. Now, in 1972, which was the last figures I have, we spent $12.7 billion on booze and $13.4 billion on tranquilizer pills. And that's more than we spent on having a good time, and that represented together one quarter of the defense budget for that year. So frankly, we pay a fairly high price to stay calm. Now, this is the current, accepted, and I think being supported by every bit of new information, model of alcoholism. Now, what about your and my responsibility for being alcoholic? You know, to the best of my knowledge, I don't remember ordering my hereditary material when I was being assembled for shipment down here. I didn't have a great deal to do with my formation and preparation for adult life. In fact, as far as I can remember, any time I tried to participate, it got me the back of a big hairy hand that knocked me over the sofa, so I didn't try very often. And, you know, people of the stature of Marty Mann have been trying to turn around this monster known as the Great North American Drinking Society for the last 40 years and only now have begun to have any kind of effect. So I think you can accept the fact that in the light of current knowledge, most of you sit here as alcoholics through very little fault of your own. But once you accept that fact, and once you accept the diagnosis, you do assume a responsibility. Because once the alcoholic recognizes how his disease operates, he also recognizes the fact that the only alternatives open to any alcoholic are to go on an alcohol-free diet, die, or go crazy. And on the basis of that information, to continue to drink is tantamount to suicide. And with that happy thought, we'll adjourn to chow.